This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence and animal cruelty that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
On the morning of January 29th, 2013, school bus driver Chuck Poland dropped off some jam for his new friend, Jim Dykes. It was a simple, unremarkable exchange between two small-town neighbors. Fast forward a few hours later, and Jim was standing on Chuck's bus, pointing a gun at the driver's face.
When the kids saw Jim draw his weapon, the bus descended into chaos. But Chuck wasn't afraid of the wild-haired man in front of him. He was an Army veteran. He knew how to keep his cool in all kinds of situations. He just had to talk the man down and convince him to get off the bus before anyone got hurt.
But Jim wasn't interested in talking. He was on a deranged mission to draw attention to his latest paranoid conspiracy theory. And there was only one way to get them to listen.
He wanted Chuck to hand over two of his students.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of 5-year-old Ethan Gilman by anti-government conspiracy theorist Jimmy Lee Dykes in Midland City, Alabama.
This week, we'll get to know Jim Dykes, Ethan Gilman, and the community of Midland City before we find out what actually happened that fateful afternoon.
Next week, we'll look at how the hostage situation attracted national attention and how law enforcement handled the high-stakes negotiations even as 5-year-old Ethan was trapped underground with his increasingly desperate captor.
School bus driver Chuck Poland was partway through his after-school route on January 29, 2013, when a man carrying a gun boarded the bus. The gunman, 65-year-old Jimmy Lee Dykes, demanded the driver hand over two kids as hostages. Within minutes, 5-year-old Ethan would be trapped in an underground bunker with an angry and paranoid Vietnam veteran demanding the world listen to him.
Over the next few days, the scared child had no idea that even the FBI and national news were focused on his survival. But his captor knew. In fact, he was banking on it.
Jimmy Lee Dykes had been angry for as long as anyone could remember. The Alabama native joined the U.S. Navy in 1964 at age 17. He served during the Vietnam War, though no one knows if he participated in the conflict or if he was stationed elsewhere.
Whatever he did during his service, it definitely left a mark. After leaving the Navy, Jim developed a keen interest in firearms. And if he had enlisted out of a sense of patriotic duty, he no longer felt that way by the time he left the Navy.
In fact, when Jim moved back to the South after the war, he had developed a deep-seated mistrust of the U.S. government and authority structures in general. As the years went by, he became increasingly paranoid, angry, and obsessed with conspiracy theories, and insisted upon talking about them with anyone who would listen.
Though he had no way of knowing it, Jim was demonstrating common symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Anger and aggressive behavior are now recognized as common in all types of people with PTSD. But according to the research of PTSD specialist Hillel Glover, paranoia and a distrust of authority figures appear even more frequently in Vietnam veterans. Studies have found that this is especially the case for those who experienced the trauma as teenagers, as Jim did.
As he struggled with his PTSD, Jim also struggled with personal relationships. When he was in his late 20s, he met a bored cocktail waitress and dancer named Nelda Lukers. To Nelda, the lanky, bearded young man with the wild opinions was anything but boring. They fell in love, and around 1976, they had a daughter, Cindy. It seemed like Jim's life might be stabilizing.
But Jim and Nelda's relationship didn't last long. Jim was violently abusive, and he hurt Nelda so badly that she ended up in the hospital several times. She knew that he'd eventually kill her if she stayed, so sometime around 1980, when Cindy was 3, Nelda took her daughter and left.
Cindy spent most of her childhood with her mom. Except for a year in Texas with Jim when she was 10, they had little contact. By the time she was in high school, they lost touch entirely. Jim didn't try to reach out, presumably pretending not to care. But the loss of his family clearly affected him.
Isolated and alone, Jim struggled to keep his life on track. He barely scraped by, working as a land surveyor or a truck driver. He gambled a lot, betting on dog and horse races, but it felt like he never won. He complained that the government and the mafia were rigging the races, and he'd only be able to win if he could figure out the pattern to it.
The fact that his life wasn't going well only fed his inclination towards paranoia and conspiracy theories. According to psychologists Karen M. Douglas, Robbie M. Sutton, and Alexandra Sihaska, conspiracy theories often stem from a person's need to deflect responsibility for their circumstances. By believing in conspiracy theories, they're able to maintain their righteous and positive self-image.
In fact, they observe conspiracy belief is associated with narcissism, an inflated view of oneself that requires external validation and is linked to paranoid ideation. Not only did Jim's obsession with conspiracy theories fuel his paranoia, but it also further isolated him from the people around him. This, in turn, decreased his chances of getting help.
Things only got worse as Jim started having run-ins with the law. Ranging from drug possession to assault, these arrests only fed his conspiracy theories. The government was keeping him from getting ahead.
Jim's inability to stay on the right side of the law led to an unpredictable, itinerant lifestyle. Sometime in the mid-2000s, when he was in his 50s, Jim ended up in Florida. He enjoyed the preparation that went into weathering hurricanes, building storm shelters, and storing supplies. These kinds of survivalist skills played into both his anti-government sentiments and his paranoid narcissism. They gave him the belief that he could survive outside the societal structure the man wanted to force on him.
But his time in Florida didn't last. He had to hit the road after getting arrested for brandishing a gun. He seems to have moved back to Midland City in 2011 when he was in his early 60s.
Returning to Alabama, Jim officially declared himself retired. He moved onto an acre and a half of land off a dirt road next to a peanut field. The property wasn't much, and he lived in a trailer that was originally supplied by a federal disaster relief program. But it was his, and he wasn't going to let the government or anyone else take it from him.
The first thing Jim did with his property was install metal cattle gates to keep out trespassers. He added a shipping container for storage and as a sort of workshop. He landscaped the scrubby lawn and vegetable garden with cinder blocks. To anyone else, it looked barely better than a strip mall parking lot. But to Jim, it was his castle, and he was prepared to defend it at all costs.
His neighbors started to notice him patrolling the grounds with a shovel and a gun, shooting grasshoppers and threatening anyone who came too close. He told neighbors he'd put out bowls of antifreeze to poison any dogs that came onto his property. Once, he beat a trespassing dog to death with a lead pipe. Another time, the kids across the street came looking for their lost dog and stopped by Jim's property. Instead of helping, he threatened to shoot them all if they came by again.
It wasn't just kids and dogs Jim got into altercations with. The police were called several times in the couple years he lived there to intervene when he threatened overly nosy neighbors with his gun. But for the most part, they learned to leave him alone.
Midland City was a rural and spread out small town. Its population was around 2,300 as of the 2010 census. Most residents were just getting by and poverty levels were high. As a result, Jim's mistrust of the government wasn't entirely uncommon, though his vehemence and paranoia were extreme.
But if you wanted to be left alone in Midland City, as Jim did, that was easily done. But its residents also looked out for their own, those who could afford to look out for each other, especially those struggling with poverty, homelessness, and substance abuse.
One such instance happened a couple years before Jim returned to Midland City. Sometime around 2008, a baby named Ethan Gilman was brought to the same public housing complex where Jim's sister lived.
Ethan's mother struggled with substance abuse, and her mother, who lived in the complex, couldn't support her. Other family members tried to help out, but the situation continued to deteriorate.
By the time Ethan was 18 months old, it was clear that his mother couldn't take care of him properly. He was put into the county's foster care system until he was 3, when his mom was able to prove that she'd gotten her life back on track.
But even though the 3-year-old was back with his mother, the instability had taken a toll on him. Ethan had behavioral and developmental issues.
By kindergarten, he'd been diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, as well as having bipolar disorder and ADHD. Not only was he on medication for all of these, but he also required extra attention from the adults in his life. Teachers, school faculty, and social workers all kept an eye on Ethan and helped out however they could.
Even his school bus driver, 66-year-old grandfather Chuck Polin, looked out for the little boy. Chuck always made sure that Ethan sat right behind the driver's seat so that he could make sure the 5-year-old didn't get bullied or get into any trouble.
Everyone knew Ethan had had a difficult childhood, but no one had any idea just how traumatic it was going to become.
Coming up, we'll find out how the conspiracy theorist veteran Jim Dykes finally turned his anger into action.
Now back to the story.
By 2012, 65-year-old Jimmy Lee Dykes was done with being overlooked and dismissed. By the time he'd moved back to Midland City, Alabama, around 2011, the only thing Jim felt he had left was the acre-and-a-half plot of land he had just moved onto, and he was going to make sure nothing ever happened to it.
Jim's neighbors quickly realized he was antagonistic and paranoid. But one of them, a man named Michael Creel, thought it was just a front. He felt Jim was just eccentric and lonely, and was willing to try to get to know him.
For the most part, Michael tuned out the specifics of Jim's angry conspiracy theories. He figured Jim just needed to vent.
But there was one time that Michael felt he had to push back. In early 2012, Jim gave Michael a ride to the local Walmart. As the two drove, Jim ranted about a new gun control law, presumably seeing it as a personal attack and further confirmation of his conspiracy theories.
On the drive home, Jim suggested that he needed to figure out a way to get people to listen to him. He had to get on the news somehow.
Perhaps he could show up at a church service and hold the congregants hostage. Well, that would get everyone's attention. And then, when the news cameras came, he could get them to listen to him, or at least to broadcast his thoughts.
Michael had been letting Jim run his mouth, but this was too far. He told him there was no way anyone would want to listen to someone who was holding people hostage.
Jim didn't like being argued with, and the two men never spoke about it again. Considering how Jim would often harp on the same thing time and again, Michael was relieved. He didn't think Jim would ever actually take people hostage.
But he was wrong. Despite Michael's counter-argument, Jim figured that taking hostages would be the quickest way for him to get media attention. It would be an immediately dramatic situation, which the press always responded to.
However, as much as he wanted a platform for his conspiracy theories, he didn't want anyone to get hurt. He was going to have to figure out a way to do this without the situation getting dangerous.
Jim was strong, but he was also 65 years old, and people in the Midland City area often carried guns. If he was going to take hostages, they'd have to be people who weren't going to fight back.
Kids were the only real option, preferably ones young enough to be obedient and not fight back, but also old enough to follow directions.
Plus, child hostages would garner a lot of attention.
Once he had his hostages, he'd have to keep them somewhere safe. Somewhere neither they nor he would be at risk of getting shot by an FBI sniper. Somewhere Jim could have absolute control over the environment. Somewhere they could hide out safely for as long as it took to get what he wanted.
Jim remembered his experiences in the military and his experiences in Florida, weathering hurricanes. He realized that a storm shelter would be the ideal location, especially if he built it himself.
In the middle of 2012, he hired his neighbor Michael to help him dig a storm shelter. He claimed he wanted an underground bunker where he could weather a tornado if need be.
The two men spent weeks digging down into the red clay earth. They didn't stop until they had a big enough space that Jim could comfortably walk around in, approximately 6 feet by 8 feet and 12 feet high. Then they strengthened the walls with planks and built a raised exterior entrance reinforced by cinder blocks.
Jim insisted they install a PVC pipe from the bunker out to the other side of the front gate. He said he wanted to be able to hear if anyone was trying to come onto his property while the two of them were working underground. Michael rolled his eyes, but he knew how paranoid the older man was.
When the bunker was ready, Jim asked Michael to climb inside and scream as loud as he could. Jim was pleased to discover that the screams were inaudible.
Michael had no idea what Jim really planned to do with the shelter. Once it was built, Jim secretly outfitted it with bunk beds. He wired it with electricity and installed lights and a television. He stocked it with food, water, and other necessities.
And he also rigged it with explosives. Jim built homemade bombs and put one in the PVC pipe running from the bunker to the front gate near the exterior end. He attached a detonator cord and ran the end back to the bunker.
He also left all the components for another bomb inside the shelter, in case things went wrong.
But what did things going right look like? Once he had his hostages, he would demand that law enforcement give him a female reporter as a hostage in exchange for the two kids. The reporter would broadcast live from inside the bunker, giving him the opportunity to tell his story on television.
And that was it. Jim had decided that he would kill himself once he had gotten the world's attention. His plan was to put his head in a plastic bag and fill it with helium, with the reporter there to hold his hand and keep him company while he died.
To Jim, it seemed like the perfect plan. Once he'd said his piece, his life would be over. He would go out on his own terms. He would do his best to open people's eyes to the conspiracies against them. He would finally be taken seriously.
All he needed now was to get his hostages. But by this point, the children who lived on his street knew better than to approach his property. Besides, he saw them as troublemakers who weren't likely to be very obedient. But otherwise, Jim didn't really ever interact with kids. He wasn't sure how he'd manage to find them, much less get them to the bunker.
However, there was the school bus that drove down his street every day. Jim saw it stop and drop off kids a bit before it got to his property. It had to awkwardly back up and turn around in order to head back toward the highway. It was the perfect opportunity to grab his hostages.
He just had to figure out how to get onto the bus. No bus driver is going to let a random man on board, and he was adamant that he didn't want to have to hurt anyone, which meant that he'd need to befriend the bus driver.
In late 2012, Jim cleared a small grove of trees along the road. It was the perfect place for the bus to turn around.
And the perfect place for Jim to enact his plan.
Everything else was in place. All the necessary supplies stocked in the bunker, and every step of the plan thought all the way through. He'd have to be a few steps ahead of law enforcement, who he was sure would be trigger-happy, ready to kill him. But he was sure he'd thought of everything.
Coming up, we'll find out what happened when Jim finally put his plan into action.
Now, back to the story.
By the end of January 2013, 65-year-old Jimmy Lee Dykes had spent months planning a hostage crisis that would get the media's attention. He'd built an underground bunker on his property in Midland City, Alabama. He'd rigged up bombs in case law enforcement didn't listen, and he'd figured out exactly what he wanted to say when he finally had the media's attention.
All he needed now was to put the plan into motion.
To 66-year-old school bus driver Chuck Poland, Monday, January 28th, 2013, was just like any other day. That afternoon, he turned off the main highway and drove a few hundred yards down Private Road 1539, a dirt road next to the Destiny Church. He dropped a few kids off and started the laborious process of turning the unwieldy bus around.
And then Chuck realized that some thoughtful neighbor had cleared out a driveway right behind where he needed to go. Smiling to himself, he backed the bus up into the clearing.
As he did, he saw a tall, slim man with wild gray hair and a beard approaching. He'd seen the grizzled man along the road before and figured he was the neighbor who'd cleared out the driveway.
Chuck opened the bus doors to thank the man, who demurred, saying, "I figured you'd like that." Then he asked if Chuck liked broccoli and carrots. Chuck replied that he preferred broccoli. The man said he'd see Chuck tomorrow.
As the bus pulled away, the kids asked Chuck who the man was. The driver explained that he must be a friendly neighbor who'd seen how hard it was for the bus to turn around on the road and had decided to help. He wanted the kids to see the benefit of random acts of kindness, and he genuinely appreciated the man's thoughtfulness.
That evening, Chuck even told his wife about the encounter. He thought that the man had seemed lonely and he might be looking to make friends.
The next day, on his morning route, Chuck brought some fresh eggs and a jar of homemade jam for the helpful neighbor. He didn't see the man when he pulled down Private Road 1539, so he just left the gifts in the man's car, along with a note introducing himself and leaving his phone number.
That afternoon, at 3:32 p.m., Chuck had just dropped the kids off on Private Road 1539 and was turning the bus around when he saw the man from the day before walking over, a plastic bag full of broccoli in his hand. Chuck smiled and hoped the man had found the eggs and jam earlier.
As he approached the bus, Jim Dykes took a deep breath and tried to stay calm. He wasn't going to hurt anyone. The bus driver just had to cooperate.
Chuck opened the door and Jim climbed up the steps. Before Chuck could say anything, Jim pulled out a Ruger pistol and pointed it at him.
Chuck was shocked. As a former Army helicopter mechanic, he'd been in dangerous situations before, but he'd never expected to be facing down the barrel of a gun while driving his school bus.
Jim handed Chuck a handwritten letter, which clearly laid out specific instructions for what he wanted the bus driver to do. It started by telling him to stay calm and act natural as he read.
Then it said, "I have a story to tell. I need two hostages to force the powers that be to listen. You will choose two smart, well-mannered, good kids, age 6 to 10, preferably boys with no physical, mental, medical problems.
The note continued with specific instructions for how Chuck should zip-tie the boys together and what he should do afterwards.
The letter promised that no harm would come to the boys, and that when Jim had told his story, the kids would go free and he would kill himself. It then continued with exhortations for Chuck to do exactly as instructed so Jim wouldn't have to shoot him and traumatize the kids any further.
The postscript read, "Thanks, Chuck. I'm extremely sorry, but I have to do this. Please don't make me do something I don't want to do."
By placing the blame for his actions on his victim, Jim demonstrated a classic emotional and psychological tactic often displayed by domestic abusers.
Chuck, however, wouldn't engage with Jim's emotional blackmail. The bus driver flatly refused. His job was to take care of these kids, and he couldn't hand them over to anyone, much less an angry gunman.
Jim wasn't counting on pushback. He told Chuck, "I don't want to shoot you. I want two kids, 6 to 8 years old. I mean it, right now."
And then he repeated his threat, "Make a move and I'll shoot ya."
Still sitting in his seat, Chuck held his ground. He said, "Sorry, you're gonna have to shoot me."
Despite Chuck's calm demeanor, the kids panicked. They screamed and hid, diving to the floor. One of the older boys, sitting in the back, called the police on his cell phone.
As he whispered to the dispatcher, Jim swung around and pointed his gun at the kids, trying to order them forward, but none of them complied.
Right behind the driver, Jim saw Ethan Gilman, the 5-year-old whose childhood had already been so traumatic. Now, Jim shouted at the little boy to get up and come with him. Chuck knew the troubled child would be terrified. He tried to get Jim to leave the boy alone.
Finally, Jim whirled back around, his gun trained on Chuck. He shouted, "I'm going to have to shoot you now. Go on. I don't have any time. The goddamn law is coming."
Again, Chuck refused to give up any of his charges.
So Jim fired.
Chuck gasped in pain, shocked that the man had actually shot him. As Jim kept shooting, Chuck's foot slipped from the brake and the bus moved forward. Within seconds, the driver was dead and the bus rolled to a halt. Over the phone, the 911 operator heard the children's screams. The boy told her the bus driver was dead. The operator tried to stay calm, urging him to stay down and promising that the police were on their way.
In the meantime, Jim was realizing that his plan had already gone awry. He definitely wouldn't be getting out alive, but there was no going back now.
Jim grabbed Ethan Gilman and pulled him down the stairs, entirely unaware that he was taking a hostage who was far from the docile boy he'd wanted. Outside, he put the little boy on his shoulders and ran as fast as he could back to his property.
Well, the boy was heavier than he'd imagined, too. He'd figured it'd be easy to carry a small child, but he was winded by the time they got to the shelter. And then he had to force the kid down the ladder, which wasn't easy either.
But he managed it eventually, the heavy door closing above them just in time to hear the police sirens turning down the road.
Jim took a deep breath and looked back at Ethan's wide eyes, watching him, full of fear. They were trapped together now. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. For more information on the Midland City hostage crisis, amongst the many sources we used, we found Michael M. Phillips' multimedia reporting for the Wall Street Journal extremely helpful to our research.
We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Next week, we'll find out what happened when local law enforcement and the FBI teamed up to try to rescue Ethan from an increasingly erratic and desperate Jim. We'll delve into the psychology and negotiation tactics of a high-pressure hostage situation with a dangerous captor. and we'll find out the hard choices that led to a dramatic conclusion.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Hostage was written by Kate Thorman with writing assistance by Maggie Admire and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.